Time now for Labor Press, your source for daily labor news and industry information. Hear discussions on the workplace and interesting talk from prominent and influential personalities in the labor community. And now your hosts, Neil Tippel and Bill Holfeld.
Accountability.
Hello and welcome to Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz right here on AM 970. And we are the program that talks about working people's issues, their struggles, and hopefully their victories. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. And my partner, Joe Maniscalco, my esteemed producer, is on vacation. So if the show isn't as good as usual, you'll know why. That's because Joe isn't here to pull my coattails when I need it pulled. But fortunately, I do have a couple of really interesting guests with me today to start today's program. And they are both from the law firm of Alephtrakis and Panic. And so I'd like to welcome to the show John Alephtrakis and Jeffrey Bromfeld. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
Well,
hello, Bill.
As we know, and we talk about it on the program all the time, we know that construction is, in particular, is an incredibly dangerous way to make a living. I don't think most people who never did it for a living don't understand just how dangerous it is. And so when you work in a field that is very dangerous, chances are at some point somebody is going to get hurt. And you two gentlemen are there to be of service to those people when they do get hurt. And so tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, Bill. Absolutely. You know, as you said, a lot of dangerous jobs going on, especially across the city now. We see a lot of construction going on. And, you know, brothers and sisters of the unions, you routinely getting hurt, routinely, whether falling or some type of dangerous situation on the job site. And that's when we come in. You know, there's so much that goes into helping a worker after they've been injured. You know, there's a lot of common misconceptions. A lot of times, you know, they really don't know what to expect in the process. And one of the things that separated us from the other firms doing this is we really advise the worker. We explain what to expect. A lot of people think this is just, hey, you know, I got hurt, I got injured, and that's really it. Compensate me, and that's it. But a lot of times, they don't realize the extent of their injuries. They don't realize the problems that they're going to have when they go out injured. You know, a lot of times, there's intimidation on the job. You know, coming from up above. I mean,
well, let me stop you right there, because intimidation. I mean, that's a harsh word. Talk to me. Tell me what you mean by that.
Oh, I mean, some of the things that we've seen. Guys get hurt on the job, and employers will say, "Go to the hospital. Tell them you fell at home. Tell them you fell down the steps. Otherwise, you're not working. You're not coming back to this site." So we get people who come to us after they've been to the hospital, created that record, which is going to hurt them later on for workers' comp purposes, and then for the third-party case, which we represent, to compensate them for their pain and suffering, any lost wages. A lot of time, guys don't realize how injured they actually are. So, you know, we all know guys who are proud of what they do, want nothing more than to get back to work, but they don't realize, you know what, my back injury is worse than I thought. It's going to put me out. And now they're out. And there's a record created saying, hey, I fell down the steps at home, because that's what they were told. That's what they were threatened to do. A lot of other times, you'll have guys who are on a worker's gang or crew, and they witness the accident. And the employer will say, hey, if you support and give a statement, you're not working here. And, you know, all we're asking for is the truth. All that injured worker's expecting is his brothers and sisters to actually be able to tell the truth of what happened so he can get his benefits, he can get what he deserves.
You know, from experience, someone who was hurt on a job many years ago and went through the whole workers' compensation, rigmarole, it's so important to be spoken to like a person. You know, John, you want to comment on that?
It is, Bill. And that's, as John has said, we break it down simply for our client, the worker, because it is confusing. There's many aspects of what happens after an accident. There's the workers' compensation. There's the third-party case. And we sit down with our clients and explain step by step. And it just doesn't stop with one visit. We stay in communication with them throughout the entire process.
And that's so important because, you know, you're in pain. First of all, you're actually in physical pain. You're usually worried about the financial consequences that are going to take place. And so many of the people that you talk to really don't understand your industry. Like I know I can remember my doctor keep telling me, well, I was so worried. I wasn't healed yet. And I was so worried about getting back to work because I needed the money. I had just bought a new house. And the doctor kept saying, well, I'll give you a light duty. And I kept trying to explain to him there is no light duty in my industry. You're either in or out.
You know what, Bill? It's even some of the things that you see. I see a lot of injured workers who just try to tough it out. So what they'll do is they'll go to a doctor and they'll tell a doctor, I'm fine, I'm better, clear me, I'm going back to work. When in actuality, they're not fine. So what I advise my clients, the guys who come to me and say, listen, all I want you to do is tell the truth. I want you to go to these doctors and tell them, hey, this is how I'm feeling. If you're in pain, let them know. And say, I have to work. And a lot of times doctors will say, okay, you know, this is what I advise you. Maybe, you know, if you have pain, work to your pain threshold. And then if you can't, come back to me. And at that point, there's not a devastating record created where, you know, the insurance companies are going to say, look, you went back after this accident and said, look, you're fine, you're 100%. That's stuff that gets used against you, just like the hospital record when they're telling you, hey, say you fell at home. All of these things people don't realize. It's our job to look out for the worker, not just immediately after an accident, but 6 months, a year, 5 years. I got to look at where these guys are going to be. They make their living. They provide for their families. A lot of these guys with young children, you know, and they provide for their families with their bodies. And obviously there's a mental component to the job, but their bodies are their vessels. And if they can't use their bodies to work, not just in the short term, but 5 years from now, there's a claim for diminishing their lifetime earnings. So this isn't just about, hey, can you work the next 6 months? Can you tough it out and work the year? But where are you going to be 3 years from now? If you have a back injury, that maybe you're not a surgical candidate right off the bat. Maybe you can live with the pain. Yeah, I mean, 5 years from now, you can end up with that surgery. You know, and that's something that people need to be advised. One of the other things we do is we really focus on the medicine. We study the medicine. We know the medicine. So explaining to the worker what happens, for example, when you herniate a disc and the nucleus propulsus, the which is the inside of the disc, starts to leak out of the disc and impinge on that nerve, and you have neurologic involvement where you're starting to get radiating pains in your arms or your legs, and how that's a progressive injury, and letting them know, hey, if you're feeling this is not a good sign. Get back to the doctor. This is something that is going to be debilitating for you 5 years from now, 7 years from now. And really laying it out so they know.
And that's the kind of advice that you're able to give that only comes from, you know, years of experience, obviously. You know, now let me throw a philosophical question at you. How did we get to this point in our culture where when somebody is badly injured and they really need help and they're going through the process of getting their legal resource to get the help they need, why do we have this culture where we automatically assume there's some big scam going on when that's so far from the case?
You know what, Bill? That is one insurance lobby. Toward the insurance lobby, it's a powerful lobby in this country, and you know, just like workers' compensation, which we're not workers' comp attorneys, but we're third-party attorneys, but the system is not designed for the victim, for the injured worker. It's not. They put you through hell. Especially workers' comp, you can go 3-4 months without seeing a check. And guys aren't ready for that. So explaining them how to navigate is maybe in the hall there's an emergency disability, the emergency pension. They can tap into their pension. There are some halls where you can put your workers' comp timesheet in, as time credit so you can keep your insurance. There are so many different issues, but really it comes down to the fact that the insurance company has created this this misconception that everybody's in it for a lottery and this and that, when it couldn't be further from the truth.
Because most of the guys I worked with were all guys that took a lot of pride in what they did, and they were happy to be out there, and they were proud of the fact that they were out there supporting their families. And the last thing in the world they wanted to do was lay down and be a log.
We got guys, you know, local 40 guys, 46, 580, the iron workers, guys who they're so proud to have their book.
Yeah, 46 was my local, yeah. 32 years.
I've never run across an iron worker that just didn't want to get out there, even after they're injured. As John said, they just want to. They love doing what they're doing, and it's a great thing.
And I'm gonna leave it with that because it couldn't be on a higher note. But before we leave, tell everybody out there how they can get a hold of you if they need your services.
Sure. I mean, it's eeplaw.com. I mean, our number's on there. It's 1-866-NYC-HURT is the phone line. We're in Manhattan, 80 Pine Street. We have the top floor. We have over 16 lawyers. We're a trial firm, full service. And you know what it is? I'm a guy who all my friends growing up, all my close friends, they're sand hogs, iron workers. You know, these are the guys that I grew up with. These are the guys that come to me because they trust us. They know I'm not giving them BS. I'm telling them the truth. I'm telling them what they're up against, telling them what they're looking at. Because like you said, there are a lot of issues. And if they know what they're up against, it can better bring those victories that you talked about.
Well, knowledge, truth, and justice is what you're offering, and nobody can ask for more than that. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both so much for taking your time to be on the program today, and also so much for what you do for my brothers and sisters out there. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Bill.
And we will be back in just a minute with more good talk right here on AM 970 The Answer with Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. You have labor questions? They have answers. Neil Tappel and Bill Holfeld, Labor Press.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld, and I'm sitting here and I'm missing my friend and producer, Joe Maniscalco, who I think he's off. I'm not sure if he's in the south of France or if he's down in Tahiti, but the point is he's not here. But we're going to do our best anyhow. And we're really happy. We've got a couple of really interesting guests again coming up. We got a couple of people from the electrical industry to talk to us next. We've got Jim McCarthy and Patrick Cadiz from Locals 25 and 1049 of the IBEW. Welcome to the program, fellas.
Well, thanks for having us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, we were talking a little bit before the broadcast, and you were telling me about how important wind power has become out on Long Island. Is that correct?
Yeah. This wind industry is a big part of the plan here for Long Island's energy needs. It seems the governor is committed to seeing his renewable energy goals and ambitions. He wants to see them through, so I think it's going to play a big part.
Okay, but how does that stack up for working people? And when I say working people, I very often, I always admit this, I have a bias, all right? 32 years building trades, guys, so how's this playing out for union workers on Long Island?
Well, first of all, Bill, I can't applaud you enough for having that bias. Let me tell you that right now. We feel the same way. The important thing here is that jobs that are created from this new technology, this emerging technology of renewable energy sources, these have to be good paying jobs that people can earn a living. They can support their families. They can send their kids to school, and they can retire with dignity. It's all too often we see jobs that come up with, from a new industry, and right away, people want to have these jobs pay at best slightly above minimum wage, and that's not what should be happening here. You know, utility workers, construction workers, they are able to build things, to maintain things that do a great service for our communities. And in turn for that, we need to be able to stimulate the economy through good-paying jobs. And we see this as as a the vehicle for the future.
You know, I got to tell you, something I've never understood about our consciousness. It's like, you know, we hear that a guy's on top of a building or on top of a tower somewhere, and we hear that he made $1,000 or $2,000 a week, and we go, well, that's a lot of money for a fill-in-the-blank. It could be carpenter, iron worker, electrician, doesn't matter. Well, that's a lot of money for, but some guy gets up and tap dances and does a bad job in a movie, and we're happy to give him $60 million. I just don't get that.
So true. Yep.
You know, the we believe that everybody should make a living wage. Everybody should be able to make fair wages. You know, whether or not you're a highly skilled worker or hedge fund manager, you should be able to make a decent wage. I mean, I had a conversation before, Tim, and maybe, Tim, you could share that what you had said to me, because it was quite inspiring about how everybody should be able to make a decent wage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, listen, and we talked about, the vehicles to get to these jobs as well. And, you know, not everybody's a college guy, and I thank my lucky stars every day. The experience of going through an apprenticeship program and receive the skills necessary for me to support my family here on Long Island with a decent wage. And I think, you know, everybody deserves that dignity. It doesn't matter what you do. There's no task too menial, for someone not to be able to put food on the table.
You know, I love that word. I love that word, dignity, because I think that's what a lot of people who are outside the union movement don't understand. I think when they look in at us, they think that all we care about is the money. Well, the money is nice because we all have to pay our bills. But I think a lot of people don't understand that for us within the labor movement, it's a lot about dignity. It's about being spoken to with respect. It's about not being abused in terms of what hours and what shifts you're working. And it really, a lot of times, it just comes down to the way you're spoken to in the workplace.
Well, without a doubt. Listen, you know, union membership shifts the balance of power in a workplace. When you're an at-will employee, when you don't have the benefit of standing alongside your brothers and sisters to bargain for decent wages and benefits, then you're pretty much you're serving at the will of your employer, and that balance of power is firmly in the employer's hand. We changed that. You know, I've been a member my entire life. I'm going on my 37th year of union membership, and I can tell you right now, I wouldn't trade my card in.
I know exactly how you feel. You know, I still have my lapel pins, and you know, when I get dressed up and I go out, they're there, and I display them with pride. But we're pretty sure we're all pretty happy about our union background. But let's get to some specifics. What's going on with all of this wind power, and how is it not going union? I mean, I would think you guys out there, I mean, you're both in the utility end of electrical and in the construction end of electrical between you. You would think that you guys would have a lock on this because you're the best trained and the most highly skilled in this area. Why is that not the case?
Well, first of all, there's never a lock on anything out there. You know, when we see employers that are engaging with union workforces or developers grabbing union contractors, they're doing it because they know that that's how they're going to get the best job done. But it's never a lock out there, because there's so many forces out there that are out there against us. With this new technology that's coming out, the wind turbines, which, as Tim referred to before, is really being pushed to meet the Governor Cuomo's vision of having 50% of all the power in the state generated through renewable energy sources by the year 2030, we're seeing that the employers that are looking to bid on this work are not necessarily anti-union, okay? But we want to make sure that this work is performed on Long Island, because when it's done on Long Island by Long Islanders, it puts the money back into our economy. And we could show that we have the best and the most highly trained workers, the best skilled workers, best motivated. We have in the IBEW, a program that we call Code of Excellence, which is meant to showcase the great work that our membership does every day.
And I'm pretty familiar with that code of excellence because you know the same thing existed in the ironworkers where I come out of. So and people don't again going back to people who are outside the trades, I think that they sometimes are not as aware as they could be of how much pride most of us take in our work.
So you said something before. How do these things translate to, you know, blue-collar union jobs here on Long Island? And there are a number of things that need to be taken into consideration when we look at that. Number one, Long Island happens to have a pretty educated workforce. This island helped put a man on the moon. We've had a great industry here for a long time. What we would need to do, we need to bring this kind of industry back to Long Island. These jobs that aren't just going to be here as a flash in the pan. Wind energy isn't going to go anywhere. So what we need to do is we need to bring this stuff to Long Island. We need to make Long Island the hotbed for this kind of work. And that could translate to manufacturing jobs where the men and women of labor are working to build these turbines onshore. It could lead to supply chain type stuff. But at the end of the day, when these things get installed, our members have the training to do it. They're going to go out there. They're going to be on the ship, out at sea, installing these wind turbines while we have guys at shore that are prefabbing a lot of these things. It's a lot to swallow. It's a big picture, and a lot of components have to come together, but I think that's how these things translate into blue-collar jobs, and they're not just short-term. You know, generally speaking, and you know better than anyone else, you know, every single job we get on, every time we step onto a construction site, we start working ourselves out of a job, right? Because the day we hang that exit sign and we walk out the door, that job is over. And we just hope that we can get on to the next job and continue working this until we, you know, have the fortune of retirement. This wind industry is just that. It's an industry that can serve probably generations on Long Island for their blue-collar workers. And that's the important part about it.
Well, gentlemen, as you so aptly point out, this is a huge topic, so we're going to have to leave it here for now, unfortunately. But I want to extend an invitation to you guys to come back. Keep us posted on this because we want to know at Labor Press, we want to know that local workers are getting these jobs and that they're good union jobs with all the wages and benefits that they should have in the wind power industry on Long Island. So thank you so much for being with us, fellas.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us, and thanks for getting the word out.
You're welcome, man.
We the union label.
We'll do. We'll do. And we will be right back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. And now back to Labor Press, your source for daily labor news and industry information, with your hosts, Neil Chappell and Bill Holfeld.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld. And I'm soloing it along today without my comrade-in-arms, Joe Maniscalco, who I miss but who is on a well-earned vacation. And we've got a great guest coming up now. We're going to be chatting in just a second with Stu Applebaum, who is the president of the RWDSU and the international vice president of the UFCW. Stu, are you with me?
Dale, it's good to be with you.
Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm going to dive right into it. I think what we'd like to discuss with you first is this Governor Cuomo proposal that we eliminate the minimum wage tip credit. What's your feelings on that?
I am delighted. I think that this is a very important proposal, not just for New Yorkers, but for the whole country. Tipped wages in place of a minimum wage do not work. We represent a lot of car wash workers who get a sub-minimum wage because supposedly their tips are going to bring them up to the minimum wage. Well, it just doesn't happen.
And you know what I always thought was unfair about that is until recently, right, and you please correct me if I'm wrong, but until recently you didn't get taxed on your tips, and that was sort of the argument, well, it's tax-free money, but now they give you a W-2 on your estimated tips at the end of the year. Isn't that right?
Well, let me tell you, I think that the problem is even bigger than that, because people don't realize when they go to a car wash that the workers are not getting a minimum wage and are going to rely on the tips. The tips often go into a tip jar, and who knows how that's going to be divided up. And in the car wash environment, you're, even if you do not receive the money that you should be receiving, it's difficult to assert that you did not receive it. What has happened is that tip wages have kept people in poverty. The tip credit has kept people in poverty and has been a constant source of wage theft. It's long past time it should have ended. And it's, I think the governor has done something extraordinary in speaking out about this.
I support the move, too. And you know, it's funny, from my own personal experience, I know sometimes I've been fortunate enough to go abroad, and you sit in a restaurant abroad, and the service is absolutely astounding, but nobody's rushing you, and you know, you're well taken care of. And that's because those workers are being salaried, and they're not worried about the table turning over rapidly so that they can get another $2 from the next patron.
Our sisters and brothers in the restaurant industry, service have told us over and over again that the tip credit often leads to sexual harassment, something that's particularly noteworthy today, and that customers expect that they can act a certain way towards the person they're going to be tipping. It's going to determine how much of a tip they leave for the person. And so that is a very bad impact that a tip credit has now in the restaurant industry.
Yeah, it's not a good social situation. But, you know, I'm very big here on, you know, destroying myths. So what would you say to the allegation that, oh, well, if we had to pay people who work in restaurants more money, then you'd put a lot of small restaurants out of business? How would you handle that argument, Stu?
It's the same argument we've heard on every social improvement that's ever been made. And I think that history speaks for itself. Every time the minimum wage has gone up, people had all sorts of horror stories about what was going to happen, and those stories have never become reality.
And we
see it over and over again. I mean, it's every time we say something about safer conditions, fairer wages, people will say that will drive us out of business. I'd also say if the only way a business can operate is by exploiting people, then maybe the business should not operate.
Well, you know, that's a pretty valid argument in my ears anyway. But I mean, so what do we think I know none of us have a crystal ball here, but what do you think the possibility is that we're going to be able to bring this to fruition?
I'm very optimistic. I don't believe that Governor Cuomo would have proposed looking into this unless he planned to take action about it. And I think that what Governor Cuomo has started here is going to have a ripple impact throughout the country.
And, well, you know, I would
hope... People should be paid. People should be paid what they deserve and not have to depend on tips to see whether or not they're going to make that.
I know, but I certainly agree with you. But, you know, when you say that it's a ripple effect across the country, I wonder, especially when I look at the most recent NLRB rulings, which are so anti-worker in terms of, you know, not being able to having a company who's a third party, not having to take any responsibility for the worker in their employ. You know, I just see a shift on the national level that's more anti-worker than pro-worker.
And yet we're seeing improvements in different areas. We're seeing improvements in scheduling for workers. We're seeing more paid family leave. We're seeing paid sick time. I believe that we certain things are going to keep moving forward. I remain optimistic about what it is we're able to do. We won't be able to rely on the NLRB. We won't be able to rely on sources that have been helpful in the past. But I think that what we're doing now makes sense, and we are going to see more and more jurisdictions following suit and doing the same.
Okay, so you see more positive, movement on a local level than on a federal level.
Oh, absolutely.
Level.
I think that's where our focus has to be. It's on the local level. It's on the, in some states, it'll be on the state level.
Yeah.
And we're not looking at the federal government. We're focusing on the local level where real progressive change is going to take place.
At least we're not looking to the federal government, at least in the recent future, right?
Unfortunately, that's true. Yeah.
No, I understand. So tell me, what else is of major importance right now to both your organizations? Because as I mentioned earlier, you're both a local president and an international vice president. And so what do we see happening on that front?
I think there are two things we have to focus on. I think that we have to organize. We always have to organize. We have to bring more people into our unions. We have to look at different ways of organizing in different situations. And I think that's crucial. And at the same time, we have to become more politically active. And I think what that means is we have to make sure that people are able to participate in voting and that they actually come out and vote. I was thrilled by the results in Alabama just a few days ago. The RWDSU, by the way, was probably the most politically active union in Alabama. We represent tens of thousands of poultry workers in the South. We have many, many poultry plants in Alabama. And we were out there. We were out there all the time making sure that people were going to vote and that they did vote. And I think the turnout was phenomenal in Alabama, and I think that's what we have to do everywhere. I think Alabama actually provides us the model. It's not just about a bad candidate on the other side. It's about our putting our effort into making sure people understood what was at stake in this election and that they came out in record numbers.
And I think what we saw
is
alive and well in the United States still.
Yeah, and we have to protect it. We have to protect it. I also say to all those people who are very upset, including myself, about the direction in Washington these days, that the real way to resist is to vote. It's nice to go to rallies. I go to rallies. But at the end of the way, if you're not voting, you're not resisting. And it's not just the big elections. It's every single election that takes place. It's every local election, every municipal election, every state election, as well as federal elections. We have to vote, and we have to increase turnout.
Well, Stu, I could not possibly agree with you more. Unfortunately, we are out of time for now, so we'll have to continue this conversation at a later date. And I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come on and talk about this issue with us today.
It's good talking with you. I'm a big fan of your show. Keep it going. I think you help make a difference.
Thank you so much for those kind words. And we will be back in just a minute with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970, The Answer.
You're listening to Labor Press on AM 970, The Answer. You have labor questions? They have answers. Neil Tappel and Bill Holfeld, Labor Press.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz at AM 970 The Answer. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld, and I have a really special treat for everybody out there. I have a special guest appearance being made in the studio, live in the studio today. I've got Neil Tappel, publisher of Labor Press, with us. Neil, I haven't seen you behind the mic in a long time. Welcome back to the program.
Fortunately, Bill, you do such a great job. And I was able to move off the mic and more to the back operation.
Yeah, but we still, Joe and I miss you all the time. Anyway, now I know we were planning to talk actually with John Samuelson today, but we couldn't get through to him, and we miss him. He's been on the program many times. He's a great guest, and we're hoping to have him on the program again soon. But what we were going to bring up with him is this idea of a phony mayor in Iowa, which is one of our stories up on Labor Press just recently. So tell us about the phony mayor in Iowa story.
This morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm sitting, you know where, reading my newspaper. The newspapers are not newspapers anymore, online. I go through about 20, 30 different press releases and articles, etc. So there it is, a note from John Samuelson and his PR director, formerly the New York Daily News writer, Pete Donahoe. And I see, boom, there it is. And I call Pete, and I said, wow, what's the story here? Yeah, the mayor is in Iowa, and this guy is a phony. And so I quickly talk about getting John Samuelson, and John says, yeah, sure. John says yes all the time.
Yeah, he's a good guy, John.
If he's available, you got to get him between meetings and this and that on the road. And there it is, and we quickly wrote an article. We were first in the nation. Now it's on CNN, and it's all over Fox.
It's nice to be first,
we
right?
We are number
it's
one. Nice to be first. We had our crack reporter.
And no, don't, you got to be careful how you say that. We had our ace reporter.
Ace
Let's not
reporter,
talk about crack reporters,
director of
right?
operations, yeah. Writing a quick feature.
Okay.
Stephanie
and
West.
Okay, but here's the – and good job, Steph. Now, here's the quote that I like. This is all because, you know John. John does not mince words, right? He says, Mayor de Blasio – this is a quote, right? Mayor de Blasio is very quick to throw his so-called principles in the gutter when it's politically expedient. He's a situational progressive and definitely not an ardent trade union supporter. De Blasio is as phony as a $3 bill. Now, I got to tell you, those are strong words, and they don't really leave a lot of room for interpretation. It's, you know, I'm tempted to say, so, John, tell me what you really mean, right? So, I mean, how do you think?
Well, the feeling for De Blasio is really mixed. He's got his pet unions, you know, that he's consistently supporting. And on the other hand, some of the other unions, he's not done well. He's spoken about supporting them, but has not supported them. And if he was more supportive, we would have more buildings being built with a union shop. And that's the reality.
Yeah. And no, I agree. Now, what do you think John means when he uses that phrase, situational progressive? I mean, that's an interesting phrase. I like that. And John's got a great way with words, I got to say. Situational progressive. What does that mean to you?
I think that if you're in Iowa and you're the mayor of New York, you could talk about all the achievements. And if you're in New York, there's not that many achievements.
Yeah, but, you know, here's something that doesn't need – the second part of the quotation doesn't need any kind of thought or any kind of translation or analysis at all. When he says he is definitely not an ardent trade union supporter, which goes back to what you're saying, right, is he hasn't really been in full support of the trades, because if they were, then we'd be seeing 80 and 90% market share in New York City,
and
right? And that's not what we're saying.
No, in fact, you're seeing – a radical change under no other mayor that I could remember going back to 40s and 50s has there been such a radical change of non-union construction work, as an example. And I don't think he's been supportive in other industries also, in the carting industry and some of the other industry. He talks about supporting, but it doesn't happen. And I think he's been a big disappointment with IBEW.
Okay.
With Spectrum.
Specifically the Spectrum issue. Yeah, should have come down a lot harder. I agree with you.
I don't think he's not harder. He's nowhere to be found. He's gone. He was at the rally. I'll support you. Go, 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 IBEW3, and disappeared. He's in Iowa.
Yeah.
He's traveling around the country, And I don't think he even made a phone call to Spectrum.
Gee, what do you think that means? Surprise, surprise, he's in Iowa. What do you think that spells out for Mr. de Blasio?
Well, let's picture de Blasio against Trump.
Oh, sounds to me like four more years of Trump. I the Democrat, I got to tell you, nobody is, I've been a registered Democrat since Moses was a little kid, all right? And I got to tell you, the Democrats recently, they just don't learn. I mean, I have never seen, they're brain dead. They're absolutely brain dead. They proved that with Hillary. And they just sit in these little glass booths and they talk to each other and tell each other what they want to hear. And they are paying absolutely no attention to what's going on in the rest of the country. I don't know. Maybe they've woken up. But if de Blasio is the next candidate, then I got to think they haven't learned a damn thing.
Is the slogan, bring New York to Iowa? Bring homeless to Iowa?
That's what we do. We just pack up all our homeless.
Record number of homeless.
We'll drop them off in Des Moines and see how that works out. Yeah. I don't know. I don't see de Blasio in the heartland. There was an expression when we were kids, right? This will never play in Topeka. Well, de Blasio is never going to play in Des Moines. You know what I'm saying? It's not going to work. It's not going to fly.
I'm wondering. I'd like to hear that speech. That he's, he's the guest and the keynote speaker today in Iowa at Des Moines, and what I can imagine what that speech is like and what it sounds like.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, just presidential aspirations. I think his ego's got to be even taller than he is, because I just don't see it happening. And of course, I've been wrong about things in the past. That's for sure. You know, when Trump first announced his candidacy, I told everybody,
it was a joke.
No way,
right?
This isn't gonna
happen. It's a bad joke.
But it happened, so who knows? Maybe we'll have President de Blasio. Can't wait for that day.
And I'd like to see it, because he did, a lot of unions were hopeful in the beginning, and he did get great support and the whole spectrum in terms of, although we can't use spectrum anymore,
right.
But the whole gamut. But I don't think he will receive much union support. Again, he's got some pets that he works with, but across the board, they're looking at, Trump de Blasio. Wow.
Let's hope that's not the choice in 2020. Listen, I could talk politics with you all day, Neil, but we're coming to that time, so I'm going to do the spotlight on American labor history piece that we do every week. Neil, thanks for sitting in today. See, all kidding aside, it's nice to have you across the desk. It's nice to have you at the mic again. It's fun. And so we're going to go to spotlight on American labor history. So on Christmas Day, 1921, President Warren G. Harding ordered Eugene V. Debs released from prison. Debs, leader of the Socialist Party, had been convicted of sedition in 1918, stripped of his citizenship, and sentenced to 10 years in prison for an anti-war speech he made in Canton, Ohio, earlier that year. In that speech, he said, "Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. And that is war, in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles. To turn your back on the corrupt Republican Party and the corrupt Democratic Party, the gold dust lackeys of the ruling class, counts for something. It counts still more to join a minority party that has an ideal, that stands for a principle, and fights for a cause." His arrest and conviction was part of a wider crackdown against dissent during World War I of all anti-war activists, including the Socialist Party, the IWW, and organized labor in general. Amazingly, in 1920, from his jail cell, Debs won close to 1 million votes in the 1920 presidential elections on the Socialist Party ticket. According to historian Howard Zinn, on the day of his release, the warden ignored prison regulations and opened every cell block to allow more than 2,000 inmates to gather in front of the main jail building to say goodbye to Eugene Debs. As he started down the walkway from the prison, a roar went up and he turned.
tears streaming down his face, and stretched out his arms to the other prisoners. Debs's citizenship was posthumously restored in 1976.
And that wraps up our show for this evening. This is Neil Tappel and Bill Hofeld on AM 970, The Answer.